Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And this is intern Elaine Taylor. What you're about to hear might inspire you to put on your hiking boots and conquer that mountain you've wanted to climb.
Or, for our City Slicker listeners, you might want to renew that subscription to National Geographic after you hear about the intriguing new research coming out of Utah State University.
Dr. Carrie Jordan and graduate student Justice Marath are studying nature's effects on our brain. We met in Logan's beautiful Green Canyon for this interview in the hopes that it would make us smarter, because, as it turns out, nature may actually improve our cognitive abilities. Jordan and Marath conduct research on this intriguing topic in the Multisensory Cognition Lab. Jordan is an assistant professor in psychology.
We're actually looking at how infants and young children might perceive different environments, so how they actually perceive different worlds that they live in, essentially. And we're specifically looking at whether they prefer to experience a natural or a built environment, and also whether they can even tell the difference between a natural and a built environment, and whether, if they can form these categories, whether they prefer to spend time in one category or another.
In their research, a natural environment is defined as anything found in nature, whereas a built environment is man-made, like streets, apartment buildings, and malls.
Previous research has looked at adults' preferences for different environments, but this is the first to study the question in infants. Studying babies is important, says Marath, because they can help researchers determine whether a preference for a certain environment is innate or simply learned.
A handful of researchers across the country and the globe actually have been looking at some of these things in adults. It doesn't really get to the bottom of, you know, what's the fundamental mechanism of this. If we can look at it in a younger population, as young as infants at 6 months old, are looking maybe a little bit older, like toddlers, that kind of at least informs the question as to whether is there really an ingrained drive almost towards being in natural environments.
Researchers can't just ask infants what environment they prefer, so they've come up with something called the preferential looking task. Marath explains.
You can't do a whole lot with infants besides kind of a few different paradigms of things like the preferential looking task, where you're just seeing what would they prefer to look at. Do they prefer to look at what we would categorize as natural, or what we would categorize as, you know, kind of built?
How do you measure things like that, since babies can't tell you what they like?
So that's exactly why we can look at the preferential looking. And, you know, you put the way our lab is set up is, you know, you put them in a darkened kind of room, and then they have two screens available to them, and you're just showing them paired stimuli of a city picture and a nature picture, and these are counterbalanced and randomized also, and you show them multiple multiple sets of these, and then you can just time them by the amount of time they would say look at the city pictures versus the amount of time they would look at the nature pictures.
So if they like something more, they'll stare at it longer, basically?
Yes.
Later we met up in the Multisensory Cognition Lab on campus so Jordan and Marath could show me what the preferential looking task looks like and better explain how their research on environmental preferences is linked to cognitive ability.
Right now, we'll just show you the space where we run our experiments.
Yeah, so this would be our infant room. As we were describing earlier with the preferential looking task, where we would just essentially have the infants measure the amount of time they look at different screens. So in this room, we would just kind of darken out this room, and then the infant would be placed in an infant, you know, in a high seat right here in between these two screens.
The test for infants is set up like this.
The baby, usually on one of its parents' laps, sits in a small blackened room. This is done to reduce distractions and make sure the baby is paying attention to the experiment. In front of the infant are two computer screens, each outfitted with a video camera.
And the parents are usually back here. We hide back here just to try it. What we're trying to do is also, since you're trying to keep their attention focused on the screens, you want to take out as much environmental distractors as you can. And then essentially we just randomly show them, you know, pictures of nature and city on these screens. And then with these webcams, we can then just record and code for how long it looked at each screen.
As results from these tests emerge, it appears infants prefer a natural environment over a cityscape, just as previous research in adult subjects has found. But why is this important? Looking at pictures of nature may give our cognitive functions a boost.
So some of the previous research has shown doing kind of basic tasks of like memory and our attention span, like, you know, holding attention span. Also, there's now stuff coming out with things like creativity. So by having exposing people to various lengths of our various types of natural or city stimuli and then testing their, you know, their performance on these tasks. And it appears that people will do better on many of these, you know, went after being exposed to nature versus built our control, just abstract stimulus.
The experiments on cognition that are run on children and adults are a bit more interactive than the preferential looking task. We move to a different room in the lab to see how cognitive functions are tested.
In the general room, through our computer-based tasks that involve children and adults, we'll run them on one of just basically a desktop computer. So they'll be set up, you know, sit them down here and walk them through the process.
The participant will see either pictures of a natural or a built environment, or abstract pictures which serve as a control. After they view the photos, they complete a cognitive task.
An example of one is for the kids is we have, like, we call it the go-no-go task. Is it's kind of a potentially taxing task where a bunch of animals will flash up on the screen, silhouettes of an animal, and then they have to just hit the space bar every time a new animal pops up, unless it's a horse. Which is actually kind of difficult to do.
Yeah, so it's a test of inhibitory control, whether they can inhibit their responses, and it depends a lot on whether they can pay enough attention to inhibit their responses. That kind of inhibitory control in the past in adults and other labs has been shown to increase when adults are exposed to images of nature versus images of built environments. And so we're curious. It's an attempt at really a direct replication of things that other labs have done, but not with children before.
So that's just really all it ends up being. And then it spits out an output for that participant. Then we can compile all the data together, and then we can look across each condition and see if we're looking at something like if they are asked to do a cognitive task after being shown the pictures, whatever it may be.
Does this have implications for people who live in cities versus people who live, like, here in Logan, where we can go outside more easily?
That's a good question. To loosely paraphrase something I heard from Richard Louv, who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, talking about what he coined as nature deficit disorder. He said, well, if as little as looking at a picture of nature has benefit, then it doesn't mean that everyone needs to run out of downtown, you know, Manhattan, because they have Central Park there. Mm-hmm. They have trees. They have plants in their house. If just a little bit is beneficial, then that's, you know, it doesn't mean you have to run from the cities into nature. But then again, there could definitely be benefits to living in a more rural environment than an urban environment, but we don't know that yet.
Right now, we don't know why nature makes us smarter. It is a question that will continue to be studied.
Future directions of the Sensory Cognition Lab include measuring people's perception of time in nature and applying what they have learned from these studies in the classroom.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows.
Hi, this is Susie Montgomery. In our next segment, we travel across campus to a lab where new research is emerging about climate change on the Wasatch Front.
Robert Gillis, a professor in plant soils and climate and director of the Utah Climate Center, along with a few colleagues, had an article published in the Journal of Climate last month. The research focused on changing precipitation patterns in Utah. Gillis's colleague gave a presentation at a climate lecture that said variation in Utah snowfall was due to land use changes. This gave Gillis an idea.
When I was listening to the presentation, I then thought, that's counter to all the papers that I've read. So I went back and looked at the papers, and the papers didn't just look at Utah, they looked at the whole Western U.S. And I thought, okay, so maybe it's time to actually look at Utah's climate and how it's changing from new perspectives as well as the perspectives that these other scientists had done.
Previous research primarily used either snow course data, which is a measurement of how much snow we get and how deep it is, or information collected from snowfall stations. These high elevation weather stations look at trends in precipitation patterns. Gillis took a different route to gather data.
So I thought, well, okay, we really need to look hard at Utah. And we're not going to look at snow course data, and we're not going to look at the Snowtell data sites. We're going to use the historical climate network, and then we're also going to use satellite data. We're going to use gridded data products, and we're also going to use new techniques of actually looking at the weather systems that bring these stations in.
The data took over 2 years to analyze.
So the results that we came forward with were kind of interesting. For northern Utah, for example, there's more precipitation coming in over time. So since the beginning of the analysis, say in the 1950s, well, the historical analysis went back even further than that. But as we looked at the trends, we saw that more precipitation was coming into northern Utah. But when you break down the precipitation into snow and rainfall, so you actually have what's called the snow to precipitation ratio. As that declines, that means you're either getting less snow or more rainfall or both. The snow to precipitation ratio has been declining by about 13%. And the reason for it is that it's coming as there's more rainfall coming into northern Utah.
Snowfall may also actually be declining, but it does not appear to be statistically significant. Changes in weather patterns, which are responsible for bringing rain and snow to Utah, were also looked at in the research. The two primary types of patterns are trough, which Gillis described as U-shaped constant pressure sitting above the ground surface, and subtropical.
When we looked at the trough type, we saw a significant decline in the number of trough instances. With the subtropical type, it wasn't the case, right? So what has happened then is that the number of troughs that bring in the weather into the state, and in the northern part of the state for sure, has declined significantly.
Less trough patterns would usually mean less precipitation. However, as Gillis explains, that is not the case.
Weather events, i.e. the rainfall events, were more intense. So more rain is being dropped by the systems that are coming in, even though they're declining.
Weather patterns aren't the only thing changing in Utah. Gillis explains.
When we looked at the satellite data for snow coverage and snow depth, they have been declining over time, even though the snow amounts haven't been declining significantly. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that the snow is melting off earlier and quicker.
Snowmelt may be due, in part, to changes in maximum and minimum temperatures across the region and seasons, which, according to historical data collected over the past 50 to 100 years, has been increasing. Additionally, rain falling on snow makes it melt even faster. So what's causing all of this, and how will it affect the people of northern Utah?
How will this changing weather pattern affect people locally?
Well, we all rely on water, right? And we rely on water for culinary uses, but we also rely on water for industry, for generation of power. We rely on water for agriculture, both in food, crops, but also livestock. Everything relies on water. So snow is really important for your water resources. Now, if that is now changing, it's declining somewhat, but it's also melting faster and earlier in the season, and more precipitation is coming, your whole hydroclimate has changed. So you're no longer getting the snow percolating nicely down into the groundwater, and then you tap that groundwater for your resource, right? For your culinary use, etc. Now what is happening, okay, is the water comes down as rain and runs off immediately. It all comes down to water resources and how they're used. Water can be scarce and you don't have enough to use it, or you can have too much and then it causes all sorts of other problems. But then, you know, you've got lots of water, but you don't capture it, and then you might go into a drought later on in the season because it's still very warm, but that water that was there has gone. It's no, you can only store much in a reservoir.
A result of increased precipitation and melting of snow may be flooding. Not only does this hurt residential areas, but it can significantly hurt farming in the region.
If you've got a flooded farm, you can't plant crops. So last year, for example, not only because of the water flooding, but also because of the temperatures, they couldn't plant the crops when they normally would do. So they planted the crops later. So then it became very important to the farmers that we work with was, you know, how long can we keep that crop there before we get the first freeze?
Not only does early melting of snow increase the risk of flooding in the area, it may also change entire ecosystems and lead to other problems, such as fires.
If you have a very slow melt-off, okay, that keeps the ground cool for a longer time. And this is very relevant for this season, where we've had all these wildfires. If the snow melts off quicker, then the sun's radiation or the sun's rays can get onto the ground and heat that ground up more quickly and earlier in the season. And that means then that any plants that are there will have less water, for example, than they usually would have over that period of time. So then you could basically say that snow on the ground is the nice refrigerator effect. If the pattern continues, let's think about it, you're going to get more precipitation as rain, less as snow. You're going to have an earlier and earlier runoff and, well, melting runoff and warming up. So potentially you're shifting the season slightly earlier, which has sort of been the case this year. That starts to affect whole ecological systems.
Gilla says things like insect cycles, flowering of plants, and bird migrations may shift to earlier in the season. This may also push animals and plants into different elevations, putting new pressures on many species. Although the paper does not directly attribute the changes seen in their data to climate change, mostly because they are inferring trends from 70 years' worth of weather patterns, Gilla does suggest that increases in temperature and extreme weather patterns are representative of predictions for global warming in the region.
So we've got all these extreme events with major destruction. These are the things that the climate scientists were saying 10 years ago are a result of global warming. So global warming is all about energy exchange on the planet. So if more energy comes in and less leaves, the planet will warm up. If less energy comes in and more leaves, it will cool down. So as we trap more energy of the energy that comes in from the sun on the planet, then the temperature will go up. And I have no equivocation whatsoever in saying when you look at NASA's data for global temperatures and you look at NOAA's data for global temperatures, since the 80s, the trend of temperature has been increasing and increasing at quite an alarming rate. Okay, so the planet's warming up, and that is global warming. And there's no doubt about in climate scientists' minds that that's the case. You can't statistically attribute these things to global warming, but the evidence is mounting to suggest that indeed the regional effects are such and are linked to this energy, this energy imbalance compared to what has been the case in the past.
If Gillis's research is correct, Utah's weather and resources will be changing significantly in the coming years.
Are you hoping that this article helps prepare the state of Utah for what is to come when they make decisions about collecting water or doing emissions testing, all sorts of things that they have options for?
Yeah, and it already is occurring. I mean, we're having the water managers come up to Utah State University for a colloquium next week. Many people have already requested a copy of the paper, and of I mean, our paper isn't the only paper. There are many papers out there. The water managers are now starting to think about risk management strategies because, as you know, as we've already discussed, we have things that we can describe within natural variability, but there is the possibility now that we're out with that natural variability. And so the water managers are starting to make plans for a risk management plan to say, least case scenario, worst case scenario, what do we need to do so that you have a plan of action in place, then maybe in the next 5 years worth of data, we'll be able to say more definitively, you know, where things are going. But the bottom line is temperatures increasing, snowfall not necessarily decreasing, more precipitation, meaning more water resources, but a different form of water resource, so the hydroclimate has changed. And then when you sort of bring it all together in terms of the melt-off in the spring season, you know, April, May, then the warming of the atmosphere is accelerating that, along with these other effects that I was talking about, windy conditions and condensation in a high humidity environment, which releases a lot of heat.
Changes in regional weather patterns mean variable, intense, and less predictable weather for the Wasatch Front. Using this comprehensive research as a tool may help the state prepare for and adapt to a warming climate. For more information, visit climate.usurf.usu.edu.
Forests cover one-third of Utah, and they are one of the most valuable resources on the planet because they are renewable and they provide oxygen for our Earth. But we rarely see them in our headlines. Today, SQ brings you part one of the series More Than a Tree from member station KUOW. This series highlights five trees that deserve a closer look. We learn about a tree that has orbited the moon, a tree that can fight cancer, and a tree that has sperm. Yes, sperm. For part one, we travel to the Capitol campus in Olympia, Washington. In 1971, an astronaut took about 500 seeds to the moon. One of those seeds ended up in Olympia. Sarah Waller of KUOW visits the moon tree 41 years after its lunar orbit to find out why its future is uncertain.
3, 2, 1, we have liftoff.
On January 31st, 1971, Apollo 14 roared into the clear blue sky. Its destination, the moon.
Roger, we're on the flight.
Humans had only landed there twice before. Each of the three astronauts on board had a small nylon pouch containing personal items they wanted to take into space.
In Houston, everything looks good here on the ground.
Edgar Mitchell took a patch from his college fraternity. Alan Shepard brought golf balls, two of which he famously smacked off the lunar surface into space.
Miles and miles and miles.
But command module pilot Stuart Roosa brought tree seeds. About 500 of them. Because before Stuart was an astronaut, he was a smoke jumper with the U.S. Forest Service. He worked in the Pacific Northwest fighting forest fires. He loved the woods. So when the Forest Service approached NASA about taking tree seeds into space, Stuart stepped forward. He took them in his personal kit, and that meant carrying them a long, long way. I called NASA to find out just how far those seeds traveled.
Dave Williams?
That's Dr. David Williams. He's a space scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Center. He watched the launch of Apollo 14 mission as a kid.
Well, the distance to the moon from the Earth is roughly about 240,000 miles, but you don't go straight there. You kind of follow this big circular trajectory.
Once in the moon's orbit, the seeds circled 34 times with Stuart in the command module, while the other two astronauts walked on the moon. Then they came back to Earth. The seeds had traveled about 1,000,000 miles. NASA put them in a vacuum chamber as part of the decontamination process. That's where things almost went wrong.
The pressure was too much for the canister and it burst open. So all the seeds came flying out and were all instantly exposed to a vacuum. So the fear was that they killed the seeds.
But just in case, NASA sent the seeds to the Forest Service to see if any had survived. They had. In fact, almost all of them sprouted. They were healthy and didn't seem any different from a group of control seeds that had stayed back on Earth. So the Forest Service started giving the moon trees away. One sapling was planted at the White House, another at Valley Forge. Another one was given to the Emperor of Japan. And one ended up right here in Olympia at the main entrance to the Capitol campus. It's a Douglas fir. It's about 40 feet tall now. You can see the Capitol dome rising behind it.
This Douglas fir tree grows too large to even be this close to a street. Something will need to change.
Ray Gleason is an arborist. He was called in last summer when cracks started showing up in the sidewalk next to the moon tree. He did some excavation around the roots and found they were boxed in by a busy street on one side and a sidewalk on the other. And for a tree species that's the third tallest in the world, that's like trying to raise a whale in a fishbowl. Ray fears that within 50 years, the tree will die of root rot if something isn't done to give its roots more elbow room.
We need to change the roads and the sidewalk here sooner or later.
The layout of the sidewalk is part of a grand plan, and it's not something you just tinker with.
That's Mary Grace Jennings. She's the cultural resource manager for the state. She says saving the moon tree is not as simple as moving concrete. The sidewalks surrounding the tree were designed by two famous landscape architects, the Olmsted brothers, one of whom helped design Central Park. So moving this sidewalk would mean changing a key design element in the Olmsted's historic plan.
And that was really something I was pretty reluctant about. I'd like the tree to last as long as it can, but it is planted in an urban setting.
The state didn't change the Olmsted design. However, they did give the tree a little extra space by shifting the location of a wheelchair ramp. But new cracks are already starting to show. No one knows exactly how long the moon tree in Olympia can live in its current location. One proposal is to use seeds or grafts from the original tree to plant a second-generation moon tree in a better location. But David Williams at NASA says that every time a moon tree is lost, we're losing more than a tree.
Well, it's like a living artifact. The astronauts and all the people who worked on Apollo back then, they're disappearing now. So it's very possible that the moon trees at some point, 20, 30 years from now, the moon trees will be the only living things that have ever been to the moon.
The astronauts are now safely inside the command module. Tonight, they'll fire out of lunar orbit and head for splashdown in the Pacific Tuesday afternoon.
I'm Sarah Waller for KUOW.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.
Thanks for listening.
That was good.
Support for Science Questions is provided by the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.